Welcome to Workforce RX with Futuro Health, where future-focused leaders in education, workforce development, and healthcare explore new innovations and approaches. I'm your host, Vantone Quinlevin, CEO of Futuro Health. The worsening shortage of direct care workers remain a topic of great concern for policymakers as well as a wide array of organizations in the private and nonprofit sectors. Today, we're going to learn about a new report from Blue Shield of California Foundation that explores this problem. With me is Rachel Wick, the foundation's senior program officer, to discuss the work that it's funding across the state, as well as other issues related to economic security. Previously, Rachel led the foundation's initiatives to integrate primary care with mental health and substance use treatment, specialty care, and public health systems. Thanks for joining us today, Rachel.
Thank you, Fawn. It's fun to be here.
Well, let's start with the topic of economic security. Can you tell us, Rachel, about the foundation and why it is interested in economic security, which might strike people as odd, given that you are connected to a health insurer?
Yeah. Well, Blue Shield of California Foundation's mission is to build lasting and equitable solutions that make California the healthiest state and end domestic violence. And to do that, we have to work together to remove the barriers to health and well-being, especially for Californians of color who are most affected by health inequities. And we believe if we do that, we can create a more just and equitable future. And so when you think about barriers to health and well-being, and as we listen to families and communities across California, what they told us is that health and well-being and family safety and stability is just not possible when you are caught in a relentless daily struggle for survival. And we know from the data that California has one of the highest poverty rates in the country when you control for the cost of living. And we haven't seen the growth in wages keep pace with the cost of living. We also know that the majority of people living at or near poverty in California are working, and many of them are working multiple jobs. They are disproportionately people of color, women, immigrants, many undocumented, and those are the communities that also experience the greatest inequities in health. So for a health foundation, focusing on economic security is clear. It's critical. And there's lots of, I'm a public health person by training, and there's lots of public health research that demonstrates the connection between income, wealth, race, ethnicity, gender, and health.
Well, that's a tall list. Health, well-being, safety, security, poverty, wages, multiple jobs. These are all very difficult, interconnected topics. I'm wondering, what can be done? What are you seeing as possibilities? I could imagine that a policymaker looking at all these issues wouldn't know even where to start.
Yes. Addressing poverty is a complex problem. And as a health foundation, where we started was to look at strategies that had a strong connection and strong evidence between economic security and health and domestic violence. And so for us, there were three kind of core areas of work that we decided to focus on. One is, how do we expand access to income supports and benefits that put more time and money into low-income people's hands? And we've seen how powerful cash, unrestricted cash support to families can be through programs like tax credits and guaranteed income pilot programs. And we also see how critical benefits like paid family and medical leave are, where people can take time off to care for their loved ones and not sacrifice significant earnings and wages in the process of doing that. The second area we decided to focus on, and I hope we talk more about today, is how do we increase wages, benefits, and job quality for care workers? And the last strategy is unique to our focus on survivors of domestic violence. And there we want to address and prevent homelessness and the impact of financial abuse on survivors.
So let's dive into the second of those three areas of your focus. Talk to us about your objective of increasing job quality in the care workforce. This is, of course, a topic close to home for Futura Health.
I came to care work and focus on care workers through participating and actually funding the California Commission on the Future of Work. And what we learned in that process is that care is one of three sectors with the highest concentration of low-wage workers in California. And when I talk about care work, I'm referring to child care work and direct care or home care work, which is assisting older adults and people with disabilities with the activities of daily living. And I've done work in healthcare, and I know you do deep work in healthcare workforce, but care workers are a critical prevention workforce when it comes to health. So child care workers take care of children and families in the earliest years at a time of rapid intellectual, social, and emotional development, laying the foundation for a healthy future. And direct care and home care workers take care of people and allow them, those who are aging and disabled, to live independently and remain in their homes and communities. But in terms of job quality, what we know, though it's very low paid, care work is complex work. It's human work that's physically and emotionally taxing. And it's just deeply undervalued. And that's because it has roots in our country's history of slavery and excluding certain workers from labor protections dating back to the 1930s. It's also the work that makes all other work possible. So I'm here with you today because my son is at a wonderful family childcare provider home, and my mother is taking care of my father. She's his 24-hour caregiver. So we know how critical care workers are to all workers and to the economy, that they allow many of us to be in the workplace. And for women to succeed in the economy, having access to care and caregiving is a top challenge, especially for single mothers. So the jobs are critically important. We could make them better paid. We could make them better quality. And I think that's, you know, we're going to have to do it with the aging of the population. We won't have a choice. I feel like we're kind of standing on this precipice of major change that could have a real impact on work and workforce.
Both the child care and the direct home care workforce is largely women. So a lot of that caretaking falls on women. And as you mentioned, they tend to be low wage. So you've done a lot of thinking about raising the wage floor. Tell us about that approach.
Yeah, I mean, the work is the work. And so what we have to do is value the work, and that means raising the wage floor. What's unique about the sector is it's very tied to our public investments in care. And so we know we have the K-12 education system that's a public investment that we've made. We have a healthcare system, you know, that we've invested in. And when we do that, we are able to offer jobs with living wages and benefits to workers. And so that's the kind of public investment that we need right now in childcare and direct care. And we came very close to getting a major federal investment in Build Back Better. We did not succeed. And I think what we've seen since then is a lot of focus turned back to the states. And here in California, in the childcare sector, one of the policy levers that folks are focusing in on is rate reform, or really changing the way childcare providers are paid in California to cover the true cost of care and to value all aspects of the work. Not just sort of the time in which you're directly working with a child or a client, but all the work that goes around that to prepare for that work. You know, things in childcare like cleaning your home and your facility, that's all work that needs to be compensated and valued. And so that's the big push right now on the childcare front. In direct care and home care, There are policy efforts underway for specifically for IHSS workers and home supportive service workers to push for statewide collective bargaining. We've seen how powerful the statewide bargaining process has been for childcare workers who are unionized. IHSS workers are also unionized, and they are seeking a statewide collective bargaining process. Right now, they have to go county by county to fight for better wages. I think another policy lever is how do we tackle some of the challenges with benefits? So 30 to 40% of the care workforce is relying on public benefits. And when you get a wage increase, you risk losing access to public benefits. And so I think some policy attention is needed, some new solutions to figuring out how do we either, increase access to benefits in the jobs through new systems and structures, or at least protect people so when they experience wage growth, they aren't, what is the process, for not losing what you have, I think is a big challenge.
Can I dive a little bit into the topic of rate reform? You talked about rate reform for childcare providers, making sure that their prep time and kind of adjacent time is compensated. How would you know the wage gain would actually go to the worker?
I think that's a critical piece of all the policy puzzle when it comes to care. Because again, when you say we need more public investment in care, what we have to do is make sure that those public investments translate and are and the worker is key in that, and that their wages do grow and are protected as we increase public investment. So one of the things that's really important is that we're seeing just in terms of a change strategy is to make sure that not only are workers organized, but they're partnering with families so that we, in all of our policy change, that we align workers and families so that we have a balanced system, right? That increases in access to care don't come at the expense of worker wages, or worker wages don't come at the expense of affordable care for families. So that's a real tension, and I think we need to build that into policy design. And I think they're trying to do that a little bit in the Medicaid program when it comes to direct care. So they're looking at things like how do you ensure that Medicaid funding, some percentage proportion, some ratios are directed toward worker wages so that they get a bigger share of the pie.
And Rachel, some of the policy levers that you're advocating, is it highly contextualized for the state of California, or would it work also in other states? And what kind of states would have a more conducive environment for those types of policy levers?
Well, some policy levers are tied to federal programs like the Medicaid program. And so there is this relationship between federal action and state action. And what kind of changes can we get federally that then would go down to California? Some of the federal work is actually offering states incentives and options to focus on this. And so it does take state leadership to say, yeah, we want to be in a pool of states that want to try something different or want to lean in on testing some of these policies. The complexity in California, of course, is our size, So I've seen in other states, like they used ARPA funds, for example, to increase worker wages. But, those were one-time funds. And so taking that play in a smaller state is really different than in a state like California, where we're such a large state. So the dollar implications are much, much higher than they are in smaller states. But I think across the board, state leadership is key. We have great federal leadership within the bounds of what the federal government can change. So we have an executive order on care, the first time we've ever had something like that, where we're activating all federal agencies that touch care to do whatever they can to create a glide path for states in particular. And that was a key piece of how California's rate reform efforts were smoothed and enabled, was through federal support. So you need both. We need both federal and state leadership. In California, people look to California, because even despite all the challenges I mentioned, you know, we're an innovative state. We're a state where people look to for a sense of possibility when it comes to policy change. And so I think we do have incredible momentum here and a really strong foundation to build on. Strong advocates, really excellent leadership at the agency level in California. We have master plans on early care and education and aging that are really moving the needle. And I think workers are named in both of those plans, but we need really meaningful focus and action on the worker piece if that is what undergirds, you know, successful transformation of those systems.
And with the big shifts that are ahead for the future of care, like value-based care or more care shifting to the home, do you see any of those creating policy windows for some of the changes that you're advocating?
You know, value-based care is exciting because it might actually be a way for those who are in most direct contact with patients to, you know, be part of a care team and be rewarded, you know, through that kind of model. But, you know, systems are systems, and I think we have a lot of work to do to value that care. You know, there's been a push to say direct care is not low-skilled care. It's actually very high-skill work, you know, working so closely with patients and honestly with families too. So we need some cognitive shifts and mindset shifts, I think, in healthcare where those who are having that really deep and frequent touch with patients are valued in those new schemes for keeping people safe, keeping them in their homes and out of institutions. So I think there's potential there, but we also just have to contend with the perception of that work.
So I mentioned in my opening that you have a report that is out. I was wondering if you'd like to do any more call out of key points or anything you would like to spotlight further.
Yeah, I mean, when I started working on care worker work and care workers, the first thing I had to do was educate myself. This has not been my like 20-year career. So what's been fascinating and that I had to learn was there are many names, many settings, and many payers when it comes to care work. And the implication of that is it's really hard to get good data, you know, on both the number of care workers, good wage data, and there's a lot of gray market activity and private pay activity, which just isn't going to be captured in a lot of our workforce systems and data systems. And so one of the reasons we did the report, I did that initial work first on child care workers, and then we did this report on the direct care workforce to just continue to educate people about who are these workers, where are they working, what are the public financing strains that touch them, or, you know, there's also a lot of private pay. But we had to understand all that to sort of bridge people who are interested in workforce with people who do healthcare financing in this case, you know, and the complexities of the way we finance healthcare in this country that connects then to the way workers are paid and where they work and all of that. So the primer was like a level set, you know, for our foundation, but other, you know, foundations, workforce advocates, workforce development people, if we really want to understand the levers of change, if we really want to commit to supporting the direct care workforce, we have to have a shared understanding of who the workers are and the policies and systems that are impacting, you know, their pay. And so that's where we started. I think one of the things that's been really interesting looking at the report is some of the history of where we've been in California. And in some, you know, at some moments, we made some progress and then we let something go, you know, let us something that had promise go and moved on to the next thing. And so I hope that the primer also gives us a sense of what's possible, that we've tried some things before that worked. We also have some new opportunities that are coming through federal change. And how do we really work together in new ways to focus on direct care, to get ready for the future, to have the workforce that we need, and really to make these jobs quality jobs, value jobs, jobs that pay well.
Rachel, how do our listeners get a hold of this primer?
The primer is posted on our foundation's website, and we're really excited to have conversations with people about the primer. The primer is a tool for us to be in dialogue with other advocates, with state agencies. One of the recommendations in the primer is that we support a solutions table in California. So again, I named, we've had the Master Plan on Aging and even the report on the future of healthcare workforce, but we haven't felt like there's just been a consistent, dedicated leadership and team that's focused on really driving change in this space. So that's what we're hoping for. The primer will kind of catalyze that kind of energy and conversation and leadership.
Well, thank you for sharing that resource. Why don't we close out by asking you a future of care question? Are there any innovations you're excited about that support health and economic security for direct care workers?
Yes, there's actually quite a few of them. One that I'm really excited about is the Home Care Cooperative Initiative. There was a home care cooperative established down in Los Angeles County by the Filipino Workers Center. It's called Courage Cooperative. And it is a model for the direct care workforce, the home care workforce, to have good wages and good working conditions. And I think we've seen a lot of abuse of workers in the home care industry. There are examples of workers who were being paid $5 an hour, working 24-hour shifts, and getting into this cooperative gave them dignity and respect in their work. It gave them control over the hours that they work, better control over the wages that they made. And I think for those who employ home care workers, it is a way to be a high road employer. So that's been really exciting. And there's a group of partners that have come together to think about how to scale home care cooperatives in California. So what's the infrastructure that we could create that would allow small groups of workers to form cooperatives, worker-owned cooperatives? And how do we give those cooperatives kind of a backbone of support, marketing, technology systems, and things like that to plug into to make the model efficient and effective? And I'm really excited about the potential of that. It also just models what is a high road employer in this industry. And if we can show that that's possible, can be a tool for regulation and pushing policy that enforces worker justice and equity in this sector. The other innovation I'm excited about, and this came out, it also comes out of the domestic worker movement, is a portable benefits pilot that's being stood up in San Francisco. When you work for many different employers, as domestic workers do, it's really hard to have access to paid sick time because you're being paid by many different people. So this project proposes to use an app-based system where multiple employers could pay in for home care workers, nannies, and house cleaners, so that they could use that benefit for paid sick time. They would be able to collect paid sick leave essentially from multiple employers and do it through an app. So that's getting going in San Francisco, and I'm excited to see what that looks like because there's just many workers who are shut out of any access to benefits like paid sick time. with really employment arrangements that challenge kind of our typical model of employer-based benefits as well. So that's pretty exciting.
So the app is not tied to the payroll service between the employer and the direct care worker?
Well, domestic workers are often in private pay arrangements with individuals in their homes. And so the app is really a way for those employers to contribute to the individual worker, like a fund to the individual worker.
And you were about to give a third example?
Well, I think the other thing I'm seeing is some of the earn and learn models are coming to childcare and to home care and direct care. I know through the CalGROWS initiative, there were some really great programs that were looking at that model. In childcare, we've seen apprenticeship for family childcare providers get going. I think the hard part is we need public investment in the earn part of the model. Lots of great providers out there to offer the learn, but we need the earn. We need a funding source for the earn part of those models.
Well, those three examples are excellent. Home care cooperative, portable benefits pilot on an app, and earn and learn models. Well, thank you for leaving us on an inspiring note, Rachel.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to talk about this workforce. They're really an invisible workforce. And again, like I said, they are the workers that make all other work possible. So excited to work on economic and racial justice on their behalf.
I appreciate you being with us today. I am Vontone Quinlivan with Futuro Health. Thanks for checking out this episode of Workforce RX. I hope you will join us again as we continue to explore how to create a future-focused workforce in America.